Most people are familiar with the concept of winning an EGOT. It means you were such a great entertainer that you managed to win an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. That means at some point you had to be the best at television, recording, film, and theater. 21 people have done it, famously people like Mel Brooks, Whoopi Goldberg, and Elton John. It can take a while. It took Audrey Hepburn 40 years. She won her Oscar in 1954 for Roman Holiday and didn't win a Grammy until 1994 when she won for a children's story album. Along the same lines, it took Elton John 37 years between his first Grammy in 1987 and his first Emmy, which he won in 2024. In different sports, there are different collections of awards to keep track of. Tennis players and golfers try to compete for a career Grand Slam, where they try to win the four big tournaments. Baseball players try to win a Triple Crown, if they can lead the league in batting average, home runs, and runs batted in. By the numbers, that's actually harder to do than winning the EGOT. Since 1900, it's only been done by 17 people. Rogers Hornsby and Ted Williams each did it twice. In sports media, however, there is no set of awards that a journalist sets out to win. While it's nice to be recognized, nobody tries to collect trophies. But some people collect them anyway. On See the Rise, we have legendary broadcaster Scott Russell. For nearly 40 years with the CBC, he's been telling stories about Canadian athletes, covering countless Olympics, Commonwealth Games, Pan Am Games, FIFA World Cups, NHL hockey, and more. Along the way, he's collected the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal for his contributions to sports in Canada. He's won Gemini Awards, Canadian Screen Awards, the CBC President Award, and the George Gross Award for Outstanding Broadcasting from Sports Media Canada. He also has an honorary doctorate from Nipissing University, where he was recently named Chancellor. This week, he was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Honor at the Canadian Sports Awards. Of course, in our conversation, we don't talk about any of this. Scott is too passionate about Canadian sport to talk about himself that much. So instead, of course, we talk about all things Olympics, with stories and opinions from his 40-year, first ballot Hall of Fame career. Let's get to it. I am very pleased to introduce my new guest today, a legend in Canadian sports broadcasting, a veteran of 17 Olympic Games, countless other world championships and high-level sporting events, a longtime part of the Hockey Night in Canada crew, author of three sports books, winner of the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal for contributions to sport in Canada. He's recently moved on from the CBC after nearly 40 years in the broadcasting business. I am just so pleased to welcome Scott Russell to See the Rise. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, Brian. Great to be here. Really interested to talk to you.
So just coming off the heels of I don't know if it's a retirement or just the next stage in the career, but when you hear an introduction like that and you kind of look back at 40 years in the business, what are your immediate thoughts? What are you proud of?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that strikes me right away, Brian, is how quickly it's all gone. You know, I remember beginning with the CBC in 1985 in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. And I just enjoyed my time immensely there and learned all about what sport can mean to that community. You know, I covered curling, I covered harness racing, the Charlottetown Driving Park, the stock car racing at Oyster Bed Bridge in Charlottetown. And it was a tremendous time. And really, I guess when you ask what I'm proud of, I guess it's more what I've been struck by and what I'm satisfied by. Over the course of my career, I've met so many interesting people who've made so many contributions to sport in this country at every level, whether it be the grassroots, at the Olympic Games, professional hockey. I've just been struck by the passion that so many people have exuded for sport and what it means to the narrative of the country. It's been really eye-opening for me, given me a sense of wonder, and that continues to this day. And, you know, even though I'm retired from the CBC and that full-time hosting gig, I'm still very much involved in sport in the country and what it means to all Canadians.
You talk about that passion, and I think that that's one of the things that people associate with you specifically is when you are hosting or when you are interviewing, it is clear how much you love the sport, how much you love the athletes, being in the arena, being on the sidelines. Your enthusiasm is absolutely contagious, and you see that even rub off on the athletes that you're talking to. Where does that come from?
You know, as a kid, I grew up, I loved the Toronto Maple Leafs. I remember my uncle, my uncle Jim, who was a car salesman in Oshawa, Ontario, which was where I was born, where I grew up as a kid. And he took me to see Bobby Orr play with the Oshawa Generals. And I remember we went to the old Civic Auditorium in Oshawa, and he leaned over to me, my uncle did, and said, "Look, if you're not watching that guy right there, you're not watching the hockey game." And of course, it was Bobby Orr. And I think he might have been 16 years old at the time. It's before he went to the Bruins, and he was just beginning to become the dominant force of hockey. But I just loved that kind of that sense of wonder about it. And I loved being there. And throughout the course of my career, that's been something that's been a continuity for me, is being there. I remember the Olympics in Tokyo, and, you know, subsequently the Olympics in Beijing during the pandemic. And I think the thing that I struggled with most was not being there. And I don't think you can properly reflect the Olympic Games or tell the story of the Olympic Games if you're not there. So that's something that's been really important over the course of my career, was to be close to the sidelines, to see all that magic happen. I mean, and sport to me is a magical thing. I mean, you know, the colors of it are so exciting. The hard hits, the kind of passion that the players exude. And you know, that kind of, I was a high school teacher for 3 years after I graduated from Althouse College at Western. And then I went back to do my graduate studies in journalism. And at the time, I went back to Western, which is where I had my undergraduate degrees from. And at that time in the journalism program, I was the only student out of 40 in the class that was at all interested in sports. And, you know, people in the program, other people in the program would say, "Oh, sports, that's, you know, the playground, and it's not really all that important." But Jamie Bone, who was the fabulous quarterback of the Western Mustangs when I was an undergraduate, a Heck Crichton winner, was the sports information director at the time that I was a graduate student. And he said, "Well, listen, you know, you're welcome anytime on the sidelines of the Mustangs to cover the team." And at that time, I ran into the coaches of the team, made an association with Darwin Simodiuk and Larry Haler, who went on to become one of the winningest coaches in Canadian university history. And they were both so welcoming to me. And I kind of knew I was in the right place. And it was by being there close to the action. It just, it's intoxicating, Brian. It really is.
Oh, I can totally relate, because I went to journalism school as well, thinking that I was going to be a sports reporter. I didn't know if that was going to be a writer or a broadcaster, but I knew I loved being around sports. Out of school, couldn't really find that job, ended up going into more technology side and spent some years at CBC doing tech. But after a few years of that, I just got bored, got out of it. And my sporting career started up after I left journalism or broadcasting, because all of a sudden I had time to kind of pursue those other things. And through me, as we kind of mentioned before, it was in curling. But then that became another job and another job. And then all of a sudden I got invited to go to the Olympics for Sochi as part of OBS because of my involvement in curling, not because of my involvement in broadcasting. And eventually found my way back and have finally married the two, but I can totally understand the passion and the desire to tell those stories. And I just love the spectacle of it all, being there, like you said, the
colors in the uniform, the roar of the crowd, the smell, you know, every venue has its own smell. So I think that's, again, totally understandable. So the other thing I wanted to mention is you mentioned Tokyo and how different it was because it was a COVID time games and there was no fans. There was limited everything, basically access to anything. And the athletes I've spoken to said that it was, you know, it's like walking around a ghost town. There was nobody in the arena. There was nobody on the streets. And it felt very un-Olympic, where I wasn't in Paris this time around, but I know you were. Give me a sense of what that was like, because it looked on TV like the best kind of spectacle that had overtaken the whole city. It seemed absolutely insane, but in the good way. And just kind of compare and contrast what Tokyo didn't have versus what Paris exploded with.
Yeah, and it's a good analogy to say it exploded. I've often referred to it in the aftermath of Paris that they were really a Renaissance Olympics. You know, after the experience of Tokyo and Beijing at the Winter Games, without a key ingredient, the spectators, that Paris, you know, really blossomed and exceeded all of the expectations that we had of those games, both on the Olympic side and the Paralympic side. You know, the crowds were record breaking. They were enthusiastic. Every venue was spectacular, was iconic. You know, I think of the Stade de France, which had hosted the FIFA World Cup and so many great rugby matches over the years. And to see the athletics there was fantastic. To see 15,000 plus people at Paris La Défense Arena, to see Léon Marchand win 4 gold medals and, you know, them chant his name all over the city was remarkable. And, you know, to be there in our position at the Trocadero, an open air position, and below us was Champions Park, which was packed with people every night as they feted the gold medalists that had won in Paris. And then to see the Eiffel Tower in the background, and to have in the opening ceremony, I was there in the opening ceremony with Adrian Arsenault of the National. And the culmination, of course, was Celine Dion, you know, singing from the Eiffel Tower, which was just a wonderful moment and was a harbinger of the great things that were to come. And it was spectacular in every way, Brian, and you put it so greatly, is that the Olympics are the greatest spectacle on the face of the earth on a recurring basis. I mean, no other spectacle can bring together, you know, thousands and thousands of people of every race, faith, gender, orientation, ability, and geographic region into one place at one time to demonstrate what is humanly possible. No other spectacle can claim to do that. And Paris did it, in spite of those that doubted it. And at the end of the Olympic Games, the head of the organizing committee, the Olympic champion, Tony Estanguet, said, you know, at the outset, people said, how can Paris host the Olympics? Paris is a city of complainers. And I don't see much complaining going on now. And he was absolutely right. You know, people, the Parisians who normally exit the city during the summer, you know, cottoned on to what was happening and they started coming back for these Olympic Games. Absolutely spectacular. It was riveting from day one to be in the Olympic crucible.
I think you put it really well too, in the sense that you said it's a renaissance, because after the Tokyo and Beijing games, where there were no fans, there were no, basically no family to kind of reset with a bang. Like they, like I said, it was the whole city. It was this ultimate spectacle. That opening ceremony, it took the entire Seine and went on for hours and hours and hours. I keep saying that was a big swing, you know, to come out of the gates going, we're going to do something that's never been done. And we're going to make it big and amazing and very French. And it was awesome. Like, just great to watch, obviously. Then you talk about the performances of Léon Marchand. And then I want to get to Team Canada, though. What was your sense of the Canadian performance, the experience? What went well? What didn't go well? What was your consensus of the... of the Canadian experience at those games?
Well, it started off really poorly, right? Because out of the gate, there was the whole drone scandal with the women's soccer team. And I remember being at the opening media conference of Team Canada, where David Shoemaker, the CEO, Secretary General of the Canadian Olympic Committee, and Tricia Smith, who's the IOC representative and the president of the Canadian Olympic Committee, and Eric Miles, who's the director of high performance, they all kicked off that press conference by talking about the potential of this entire Canadian team. And the fact that Canada had Summer McIntosh in the pool, who was a phenom. They had Andre DeGrasse on the track. They had the world champion hammer thrower in Ethan Katzberg. They had so much going. They had the basketball team with Shea Gilgeous-Alexander for the first time since 2000. So there were all these hopeful things that they were talking about. And then they opened it up to questions from the assembled media, and all they wanted to talk about and ask about was the soccer scandal. And, you know, it was a downer, and it was not the way that Canada wanted to begin these Olympics. Usually at the Olympic Games, internationals talk about Canada glowingly and with sort of a great reverence and, you know, they're the good guys. And all of a sudden the tables were turned and there was this sort of dark cloud hanging over Canada. And then what happened was Summer McIntosh got in the pool and was absolutely spectacular, dominant, lived up to every billing. You know, 17-year-old who stole the show for Canada and turned the tables. And then what happened was that the women's soccer team, although sanctioned and playing against all the odds, they had to win every game or they weren't moving on, and they did. And they were defiant. And they said, you know, we've earned the right to be here. That scandal is about something beyond our control. And, you know, we're here to play. And they then changed the narrative. And then, you know, the Canadians got on the track. And Ethan Katzberg wins the gold medal in the hammer throw. And Cameron Rogers, this delightful young woman from Richmond, British Columbia, wins the gold medal in the hammer throw. You know, wonderful story, great person. And all of a sudden people were talking glowingly about Canada again. And so, you know, the entire experience for the Canadians, if you want to put a bow on it, turns out to be very positive. 27 medals won, the most medals won at a non-boycotted games. All positive, and that soccer team turned the tables. I think, Brian, that the Canadians did exceedingly well, and some great characters came out of the whole thing. And then the capper had to be the 4x100-meter relay. And Aaron Brown, you know, who's the veteran of the team, blasted off at the start, destroyed his rival Christian Coleman of the United States, who's a former world champion, and the race was done. I mean, the Canadians were clean on the handoffs. They were fantastic. And Andre DeGrasse brought it home, beat his man, and the deal was done. And that was sort of symbolic of the team effort that was Canada at these Olympic Games. It was a great way to cap it off.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head with the soccer team setting the tone even after their penalties, right? They said, well, fine, you're going to take away all our points. Well, we're going to go win them all back and find our way through. And even though they didn't reach the podium, that was more of the sheer, you know, that truculence, you know, that Brian Burke always loved to talk about.
Yeah.
It was the stubbornness and the fight and the grit to say, we're going to do this anyway. And I really loved that. I agree with you. So totally set a tone of what there's no quit here. We're not going home, and we're going to bring even more the next time. I really enjoyed that. And yeah, that 4x100 was a great race, especially because Canada wasn't even necessarily in the conversation as a team that was supposed to win it. And they kind of did it easy.
Yeah, no. And it was totally a team effort. And, you know, I guess one of the things that came out over the course of the Olympics on several fronts was the concept of trash talking, which, you know, is it's endemic in modern day sport. You know, trash talking has become part of the backdrop for all kinds of sport. And so, you know, Vanessa Gill of the soccer team, you know, says, I don't care how many people trash talk us. You know, we're here to play, and we are athletes, and this is what we're going to do, and we're going to fight through this, and we're not listening to the trash talk about Canada. Great. And then, you know, Noah Lyles makes a huge mistake for the United States in advance of the relay when, you know, who are your rivals in the 4x100 final? Could it be Canada? And he says, who? I mean, and you're talking to guys like Aaron Brown and Andre DeGrasse after that, Brendan Rodney, you know, they go, hey, that's fine. Talk the way you want to do. We're going to go about our business. And the trash talking is not what Canadians do. They just go out and have a fantastic team effort. And, you know, Brian, one of the things that was lost in all this, and I hasten to bring it up, was the guy that brought it together for Canada was the coach, the head coach of Athletics Canada, is an Olympic champion in the relay, and that's Glenroy Gilbert. And he made sure that those four guys who had been together over a number of years were going to make every clean exchange, and they were going to act as a team when they went into that relay final. And they did. They followed the playbook, and they were brilliant.
I feel that that's something that the U.S. always screws up. They've got four of the best runners, but they don't have the team. The exchanges are never clean. You know, you think that they're going to win by a mile, and, you know, they can't get the team aspect of it down. And it just seems like one of the easiest things to practice, you know, spend an hour a week working on your exchanges. And it seems like every 4 years, they don't do it very well, and it costs them medals. I just found that I totally agree that the team aspect of it and the exchanges won that race, whereas, yeah, probably USA and some other teams had four faster guys, but they couldn't get the critical part of the exchange down.
Well, you know, it's crazy, right? Because the American guys, they have 10... maybe 12 athletes that are sub-10, 100-meter guys. Canada's got two guys that are sub-10, 100-meter runners. However, the team that sticks together and is able to get the stick around, as Donovan Bailey says, is likely to win the race. And I'm sorry, but there's no better anchor in the world than Andre DeGrasse. When he gets the baton and is challenged and he takes it on the fly, is you know, he's sub nine. I mean, he's brilliant in that anchor leg. So yeah, that is key. The Canadian team effort is absolutely the reason why they won that 4x100. And you know, like, you know, the CP awards will come out at the end of the year, and they'll have, you know, the male athlete of the year, they'll have the female athlete of the year in Canada, and then they will have the team of the year in Canada. Guaranteed, it's that 4x100 meter relay team.
Most likely, I think you're probably right. I was happy. I don't know Andre DeGrasse. I'm sure you do. But I was happy for him, especially after the way his other events went, the fact that he was fighting an injury, and the fact that he was able to close out a gold medal race and still go home with some hardware. That made me, you know, brought me some joy as a fan. Like, I was cheering for him. I wanted him to do well. And to finish that way, I think was really, really exciting. And it you know, kind of lifted my spirits, because he was, you know, he's one of the faces of the sport in Canada. And when he didn't quite perform the way he wanted to have another chance and bring it home, I think was probably really good for him.
Yeah. And, you know, he shoulders the burden of great expectations, you know, based on what he's done over the course of his Olympic career and his world championship career. I mean, he's the champion at 200 meters from Tokyo. And so people expect all of this from Andre DeGrasse. He's a wonderful community person. He has a foundation, and he makes a difference in the lives of so many kids in his community. He is revered in Markham, Ontario, and revered around the country. And, you know, Andre, I've known Andre DeGrasse since, you know, before 2014. And I remember being at the Canadian track and field trials before the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2014. And we were doing the FIFA World Cup from Toronto at that time. And after the first round of the FIFA World Cup, I went to Moncton, New Brunswick for a day to do interviews at the Canadian track and field trials for the Commonwealth Games. So I was on a pretty tight window because I had to get back. We had a broadcast the next day. And I did a ton of interviews. And then Matt Gentes, who runs Athletics Canada, came to me and said, have you got time for one more interview before you get to the airport and get on your plane? And I said, yeah, I'm pretty tight, but I can do one more. And he said, it's a young guy. He's a sprinter. We don't really expect that much to come from him, but he's a really nice kid. And wouldn't it be great if you could just give him a couple minutes? His name's Andre DeGrasse. And here comes Andre DeGrasse. He had cornrows at that time in his hair. He was kind of starstruck, wide-eyed, you know, a deer in the headlights. And, you know, didn't have a lot to say. And little did I know at the time that this guy was going to become perhaps, you know, the greatest, one of the greatest sprinters in Canadian history, and one of the best in the world. He's a fantastic guy. And I too was extremely happy for Andre DeGrasse to see that gold medal come his way.
I want to shift gears slightly, but just on the same theme, you said Canada record medal haul. And no doubt that was a great performance, but what was almost more frustrating was how many fourth place finishes we had. And I think it was 15 or 16. And in some cases, just milliseconds off the podium or a half a second or just missed it. And the question, I mean, I like to ask people just for a sense of perspective, like, do we put a little too much stress on the top three places? When, you know, you could have a race that started with 100 participants and you got to fourth place by a tenth of a second, but that's a disappointing result.
Yeah, I think that's only natural. And I think that that Canadians, you know, we've become accustomed since, I'm going to say since Vancouver in 2010 and the advent of Own the Podium, we've become accustomed to being a very successful country on the Olympic front. You know, we as Canadians like to win medals, and it means something when Canadians win medals. And I know there's been a lot of talk in recent times about do we put too much emphasis on winning? And in talking to Anne Merklinger, who you know is the CEO of Own the Podium, former curler, high-performance curler and swimmer for Canada, she says, do we put too much emphasis on winning? I don't think so. I think what we need to do is put emphasis on winning, but winning the right way. And, you know, when you're winning the right way, there are going to be those fourth place finishes, close calls. You know, I think of Kylie Moss in the swimming pool. I think of Evan Dunphy in race walking, come so close, right? In really big events. Some of the judokas came forth. So I think that my own personal opinion is that I think Anne Merklinger is right. I think we have to continue to want to win, but to win in the right way, with dignity, a sense of values, and you know, that we want to be competitive performers at the Olympic Games.
So in your opinion, does COC need to do something differently, something better? Does Own the Podium have to change their approach, or is everything trending in the right way?
I think things are trending in the right way. I mean, you know, Own the Podium is in the business of evaluating where the stakeholders might best invest their money in terms of supporting a particular national sports organization with regard to efficiency and productivity. So, you know, we see potential in Swimming Canada and a potential to produce a lot of medals. You know, Canada had not produced a medal since 2000, you know, before we got to kind of 2008 in Beijing, and then it was Ryan Cochran and Brent Hayden won a medal in 2012, but it was few and far between. And then 2016 comes around, and Kylie Moss and Penny Oleksiak are producing medals, right? And that women's swim team, and then comes Maggie McNeil and those people. And so the program continues to build. So I think that Own the Podium and the Canadian Olympic Committee are going down the right route. We're a small country, you know, in comparison to the United States, the United Kingdom, some of the other powerhouses, Germany. We're a small country. We're kind of punching above our weight. And, you know, I think we're going about things the right way.
I think what a lot of people don't necessarily understand is when especially funding does get distributed through Sport Canada or the COC, it goes to, like you said, an NSO. It goes to Swimming Canada or Rugby Canada or whatever. And then it's really up to them to decide how it gets spent. And so it's not the COC or On the Podium who's making the decisions on where those dollars actually go, whether it goes to the athletes, whether it goes to development or some programming or new facilities. So there's this constant breakdown of, again, I just don't think your casual fan kind of knows the landscape of sport governance in this country, and they'll complain about all the wrong things.
No, I agree with you 100%. You know, like Own the Podium and the Canadian Olympic Committee are in the business of targeting sports and producing results. But, you know, in recent times, under the microscope has come those NSOs and the way they are governed. And, you know, in certain instances, the governance of certain NSOs in this country has to be cleaned up. You know, you think about Bobsleigh Canada, you think about Rowing Canada, Gymnastics Canada.
I think you have to bring soccer into that.
Definitely have to bring soccer into it. The governance has to be cleaned up. And really, that's up to the NSO. You get your house in order and, you know, we can continue to invest in your operation, which is well run, which is run with value and integrity, but also with a view to being competitive. That's what it's all about.
I think I keep going back to curling because that's what I know the best, but there's always the argument of, do you develop grassroots curlers or do you try to fund your high performance team? And the argument I always have is, does that need to be the job of one company? Could there not be a one group that focuses on this and one group that focuses on that? Because it's a totally different world of getting bodies into your sport and then getting those bodies to the top of your sport. It's a very different goal. And I just don't think that, well, again, a lot of people don't wrap their head around the fact that there are conflicting desires even within the same organization.
Yeah. And you're right. And one of the things that really comes into play, Brian, and it applies to curling, it applies to every other sport, and it's the old adage, to be it, you got to see it. And so you cannot believe the number of young women that were influenced by Cameron Rogers winning the hammer throw gold medal at the Olympic Games. I mean, that turns a whole, you know, cadre of young women onto her sport. They want to be like Cameron Rogers. The same is true of Summer McIntosh. The same is true of Eleanor Harvey, who won a beautiful medal in fencing in front of the, you know, that massive crowd, that spectacular venue at the Grand Palais. You know, that turns kids onto fencing. So you have to have a role model to aspire to and say, look, you can get there if you work at it, if you're properly supported, if you're committed and show some passion. That is what is possible. So you need both ends of the equation.
And I think one of the other things that comes up not as frequently in Canada, because we don't tend to host so many of these games, but the legacy of the infrastructure, when you have a Vancouver or a Calgary or even Pan Ams in Toronto or Winnipeg, you build the facilities where some of these people can not only see the next generation of the athletes competing, but also then there's a Olympic sized pool there. And then there's a track and a, you know, a new basketball facility. So if you look at any time you host a games, it doesn't even have to be the Olympics. There's lots of other ones. When you build new facilities and infrastructure, you start to see people who have, oh, I've been training at the Markham facility for swimming, or Basketball Canada isn't there now too. And then anytime they build something new, you're going to kind of inspire that next generation as well.
Absolutely. And I think hosting major events is another part of the puzzle. You know, I think of track and field. You know, Canada has done very well in track and field at the last couple of Olympics in particular. Well, I would go back to, say, 2016 in Rio. So Rio, Tokyo, and Paris, Canadian track and field athletes have done very well. In spite of the fact that we don't, on an annual basis in this country, host a major track and field event. I'm thinking of, okay, we have the Harry Jerome Classic at in Burnaby, BC, right? But that's one off. But I'm thinking, like, what about a Diamond League event in Canada? I mean, there's one in Eugene, Oregon, which is, you know, Tracktown USA. But if the Diamond League is going to come over to North America, why wouldn't we try to host a Canadian stop, whether it's in Vancouver? But we need a facility. And I have to tell you, Brian, like, you know, we're a very prosperous country. In spite of everything that's happening, we're a very prosperous country. And I think one of the things that we need to recognize in Canada is how important sport and high performance sport, Olympic and Paralympic sport, is to the national story, to the narrative of the country. So why is it that, you know, this world-class city would not venture to make a proper Olympic bid? You know, like Toronto should take a run at the Olympics. We should. I mean, if you believe in sport and the power that it has, I can't imagine how great an Olympics would be in Toronto.
So if I'm sure you recall, they did do a bid. They were trying to get the 2008 games.
Yeah.
And it actually had a lot of steam behind it and eventually lost out to Beijing. But that was the last time I ever heard that conversation even happen. Then we had Pan Ams in 2015. And you say Paris is a city of complainers. Toronto, I think, could rival them as far as, oh, well, traffic was worse and I couldn't get where I wanted to go. But think of how much good stuff that brought to the city while hosting those Pan Am games. It was actually a hugely successful event. But I think the local citizens say, well, it's not the Olympics, so I'm going to whine about the traffic.
Yeah. And what came out of the Pan Am games in 2015? Well, you know, Penny Oleksiak came out of that. Andre DeGrasse came out of that. All of these great achievers came out of those games. The Pan Am Para Pan Am Sports Center in Toronto continues to be an incredible legacy piece for not only the city, but for the province. Canadian Sport Institute Ontario is hosted at the Pan Am Para Pan Am Sports Center out at Scarborough College and the university. And we continue to produce champions and a legion of champions out of that facility.
I had the good fortune of that one to be the press manager for the beach volleyball venue. And Melissa Humana Paradis was playing in those Pan Ams. And so I got my first look at her almost 10 years ago now. And now she's Olympic silver medalist.
Yeah, you know, like I remember when Melissa and her partner was Taylor Pischke at the time, right? And of course, Taylor is the daughter of Garth Pischke, who's got, you know, this great volleyball legacy. And now Canada has got a great men's volleyball team, a great women's volleyball team on the court. And also we're very strong in beach volleyball. And that comes out of the Pan Am Games and hosting a major international event.
So if you were to wager a guess, where or when does the next Canadian Olympic bid come from?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. I thought that Vancouver was really going to take a run at 2030. And I know the Canadian Olympic Committee was hugely behind it in talking with people like Tricia Smith. And then what happened is the premier of the province scuttled the bid because, you know, it's not a priority at the time. It will never be top of mind if a country is short-sighted and looks only to solve the problems of the day. But if you want to build something, I think you have to look at what sport can be in terms of a builder of the community, a pillar of any community in the country. I think that at some point, I think Toronto will in the future make a bid for the Olympic Games. It's the next logical site. I mean, we're covered until 2032 in Brisbane, Australia. We will have just had a Summer Olympic Games in Los Angeles. Probably Europe is going to get another bid. But down the road, I mean, Canada's a progressive country, and it should host the Olympic Games. And this city is a natural choice.
And talking just about the facilities, if you've already done it or similar games in recent memory, you don't have to build everything new. You don't have, like, Toronto's got the arenas, they've got the fields, they've got the pools, so they wouldn't actually have to create that much more to make it work. Same with Vancouver, you've done the Olympics in 2010, so most of those venues are probably still intact. Calgary, to a degree, has most of that stuff. So, yeah, I totally agree there should be a bid, but I just don't get the sense that it's a priority. And I feel like fewer and fewer cities around the world, fewer countries want to host because it is such an undertaking.
It's such an undertaking. And, you know, one of the things that mitigates against this is the actual size of the Olympic Games. You know, I'm thinking when Calgary hosted the Winter Games in 1988, it was the first time really that a big city had hosted a Winter Games. It used to be ski stations, you know. But Calgary is a big city that hosts the Games, and yet they were much smaller than they are now. And the Summer Games are absolutely massive now. And I wonder sometimes if the Olympics have maybe outgrown themselves. And I wonder if sometimes we need to get back to the basics with regard to the Olympics and make them more attractive to cities that have existing facilities and can reuse existing facilities. Like, you know, like Helsinki hosted a fantastic Olympic Games in 1952. They have a major stadium and they were wonderful games, but they were much smaller, much more intimate. I wonder, I mean, big time sport these days is, well, you know, it's absolutely massive.
I thought what Paris did was very creative in using these historic buildings and just kind of, you know, the Grand Palais. Like, we're going to put fencing and what else do they have there? Taekwondo or something.
Yeah.
And then these just these temporary facilities, but in these historic buildings. I thought that was really, really cool. Good way to showcase your history and your culture, but also kind of it gave the game such a unique character. So it's like you don't have to build a multi-billion dollar stadium when you've kind of got some other options like that, I guess.
Beach volleyball was case in point, spectacular. Temporary stadium and grandstands at the foot of the Eiffel Tower. How good did that look? I mean, it was spectacular, right? And the fans jammed the place. You know, they had obviously La Défense Arena where the swimming took place, which was a massive venue that can still be used. And it's a multi-purpose venue. Like, you can blow it up and play indoor soccer in there with 32,000
people. They didn't build very many new venues. No, I think there's only one or two, right?
One or two new venues. The aquatic center where they had the water polo and the artistic swimming was a new venue. Very nice venue. Stade de France was already there. They had the equestrian events on the grounds of the Palace Versailles. I mean, spectacular.
Yeah,
right?
That, again, just really kind of showcasing the history and the architecture. And like, I loved that they did that because it was like, wow, yeah. Have you been to Paris lately? Now I want to go. I haven't been to Paris in almost 20 years, but I was just like, man, I got to go back to Paris. They got some cool stuff.
Yeah.
I want to get just to shift gears a little bit, because this is something as I was reading up on you, I really didn't know anything about. It says you're on the board of directors for the International Center for Olympic Studies at Western University. Can you just tell me a little bit about that and what that organization does, and just fill me in on that?
Yeah, you know, and it's actually a really interesting institution, because the International Center for Olympic Studies at Western is one of only two of its kind in the world, and it's an academic research center. Dr. Angela Schneider is the director of the center. She's an Olympic silver medalist from 1984 in rowing in Los Angeles, and it's an academic institution that studies the Olympic Games, the foundations of the Games in its antiquity and in modern times. The former director of the center is Dr. Kevin Walmsley, who is now the president of Nipissing University in North Bay, Ontario, where I'm the chancellor, and that's my connection to him. But, you know, it's a think tank about the Olympics and what the Olympics mean and to a certain extent the Paralympics mean to Canadian society, to international society. It publishes academic research. It publishes a periodical, Olympica, about all that's going on with regard to Olympic study. It talks about the issues that confront the Olympic Games, gender equality, what happens with trans athletes, and that continues to be an issue. I think it's a fantastic jewel to have at Western University, but also to have in Canada. And it probably deserves a lot more attention because they're doing some great work into what the Olympics mean to us as a society.
Do they offer courses or certifications?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can go and study at the International Center for Olympic Studies. You can earn a degree in Olympic studies and, become a doctoral candidate. It's a pretty robust organization. Small, but growing.
So you mentioned Nipissing. Obviously, this is a career shift for you as recently installed chancellor. What does a chancellor do?
Well, a chancellor is the titular head of the university. It's a ceremonial position. And you grant the degrees and you become basically one of the ambassadors of the university. It's a tremendous honor to be the chancellor at Nipissing. Nipissing is in North Bay, a gateway to Northern Ontario. The university has about 5,000 undergraduate students. It has a tremendously productive School of Nursing, a school of education, and at Nipissing, they've been in the business of education for a long time, since it was a normal school in 1909. So it's graduating teachers. It has a business school. There's a commerce program, criminology. It's a very progressive campus, and it's an accessible university with 10% of its full-time population being Indigenous students. And there's a very strong and important Indigenous community in the North Bay area. So what I love about Nipissing is the importance that it has to the entire region of Northern Ontario. But it also can serve as an example for studying in an accessible place and making a difference in your community. I'm tremendously excited about the challenges that this role brings. And I was at the Ontario University's Fair a couple of weeks ago to be at the Nipissing booth and to kind of pitch the university. And it was really exciting to meet all of these passionate, grade 12 students who were looking for a place to continue their education. And a lot of them came through our booth and, they really sparked when they saw our campus and the pictures of our campus and noticed the accessibility of the place. So, really exciting.
And that's a five-year term that you've agreed
Four-year term, and then, it could be a maximum of two terms.
So did you ever assume that's where your career was headed, or was that something that was always on the radar?
You know, I went through high school, and I always wanted to be a teacher, and I was a high school teacher in Owen Sound, Ontario for better part of 3 years before I went back and did my graduate degree in journalism. And I enjoyed teaching. I especially enjoyed the coaching. I was a basketball coach, volleyball coach, and loved that. Wasn't keen on disciplining students who didn't want to be in school. But I really had an amazing university experience, not only socially, but also academically, and I ran into wonderful people, wonderful instructors, professors, who made a difference to me. And I think that a university education really goes a long way to developing a next generation of leaders in all of our communities and liberal thinkers, people who are can be creative thinkers, but also who have an academic rigor that I think is really important in today's society. So the ability to go back into academia to a certain extent is really attractive, because you know the way I look at my career in broadcasting was that I've kind of been teaching all the way along, and you know I you talked about Hockey Night in Canada at the outset, and I worked on Hockey Night in Canada for 14 years and tremendously enjoyed that experience, but I chose to focus on Olympic sport when a lot of my other colleagues wouldn't make that choice. And that's what I wanted to do. And I kind of grew that, I hope, in the minds of many Canadians. And it became a way of sort of continuing to teach
people. And I mentioned it, I think, before we started recording, that the whole point of this podcast is to try to bring some of that Olympic coverage into non-Olympic years and go into the weeds in the odd numbered years, you know, where we're not going to be in Paris or Milan or wherever we're going next, but these athletes are competing generally 10 months a year, whether it's the Olympics or not. And I think you'd agree that they need a little love in those other years too. So I know that you're one of the people who actually does pay attention when it's not that Olympic year, and that you've done a great job of, like I said, right out the outset, bringing that passion and the enthusiasm to those Canadian athletes. So I think they would thank you. I'll thank you on their behalf. Before we go, I want to give you a couple of rapid fire questions just for fun. You've done 17 Olympic Games. Which was your favorite?
Aside from Paris, which was fantastic, Beijing 2008, colossal. To see the crowd at the Bird's Nest, 90,000 strong, absolutely spectacular, and China was a wonder.
So I'm going to tell this story. I think I did already on one of the other episodes, but I was with the Paralympic team in Beijing this time around, and because it was a COVID Games and everything was locked down, I didn't get to see anything. So I had a very different experience in Beijing.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Games moment?
My favorite Games moment is, well, listen, I'm going to give you two, winter and summer. Winter, 2002, Salt Lake City, Becky Scott from Vermilion, Alberta, little community in the north of Alberta, wins Canada's first ever medal in cross-country skiing. It was bronze at the time. She became an iconic figure who, you know, was racing against doping Russians, and it eventually became a gold medal. So there's the winter moment. She's an absolutely spectacular role model for Canadians. Summer moment, when Kyle Schufelt, that little guy from Calgary, Alberta, won the gold medal in the floor exercise at Athens in 2004, put the laurel wreath on his head, lifted his coach, Kelly Manjack, up. Fantastic moment. He's a great guy.
The last thing I'm going to ask, because I've taken up enough of your time, is I just was flipping through your Instagram lately, and I found out that you are an enthusiast for the polar bear swims.
Definitely an enthusiast for the polar bear swims. That comes from my camp days when I was a little kid, and I, you know, became a counselor and assistant director at a camp in Haliburton, Ontario, and we would go for the polar bear swim every morning before breakfast in the mess hall. And I continue that to this day because I have a cottage on the same lake as the camp is situated where I went to so many years ago. And you know what, Brian? A couple years ago, I had a polar bear swim every month of the year without fail. Sometimes I have to cut a hole in the ice, but I continue to love the polar bear swim.
How long do you stay in and when it's cold?
You know what? It's not how long you stay in. It's if you get in, Brian. So, I'm not going to put a time limit on it. I get in and I've done my bit.
I
I would be getting out pretty quick as well. Again, I want to thank you so much. I could talk to you all day, but I've taken up enough of your time. So I appreciate you taking the time and for everything you've done for CBC, for CBC Sports, for Canadian sport, and for sports fans everywhere. Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Great to speak with you, Brian. Thanks so much.
See The Rise is a Left Button production. Follow us on Instagram at seetherisepod or email us at seetherisepodcast@gmail.com.